This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a story of passion and longing. Hewlett-Packard and Dell, two powerful, aging computer makers, each lusting after the same partner. And who is this object of desire? Why does she have these two computer companies floating on a cloud? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke. I'm in for Kai Ryssdal this week. And I'm so glad you're here. It's Monday, August 23rd. Now for that computer dating. Hewlett-Packard and Dell are rivals again, each of them seeking the hand of a company called 3PAR. And who's 3PAR? Well, she's in the business of data storage, which I know does not sound very sexy. Why are these big firms competing so hard to win 3PAR's affections? Marketplace's Janet Babin has the story.
HP is bidding $1.6 billion for data storage firm 3PAR, 33% more than what Dell agreed to pay for 3PAR last week. Why is data storage such a big deal? Benjamin Wu is with research firm IDC.
Whether it's ATM transactions, whether it's just going to a supermarket, it's all dependent on the storing and the retrieval of information.
And that's essentially what 3PAR does. It enables cloud computing that lets companies store data securely online. It organizes data on corporate servers. Computer expert Dan Bricklin of Software Garden explains it like this. Say your company is doing an online promotion that could draw millions of customers to your site in a short span of time.
Rather than buying 10 times extra computing power, you basically use it from a shared place on an hourly basis.
With 3PAR, firms gain more storage capacity during peak times without investing more money. With the recession constraining IT budgets, that makes 3PAR even more valuable. And it may be smarter for companies like HP and Dell to buy their way into data storage. Karan Mahendru is a principal with early-stage venture capital firm Trinity Ventures.
They could take 5 years to develop the same product, but given that these companies are available relatively on the cheap side, I think it's probably a good decision at this point.
Mahendru expects Dell to counteroffer, and another player could enter the fray, driving the price for 3PAR even higher. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
And the fight for 3PAR is not an isolated case. We're actually seeing a little summertime flurry of mergers and acquisitions. You may have heard about Intel taking over the security software company McAfee. Then there's the global kings of mining and fertilizer doing some kind of mining fertilizer mating dance. And there are other deals going on as well. While it is nice to see companies investing in something, let's not forget that with mergers usually come layoffs. I mean, companies merge in part so they can be more efficient, meaning they don't need as many employees. Now, the idea of becoming one of those suddenly unnecessary workers is a scary thought right now. But maybe the situation is not as scary as we media types would have you believe. This morning, the outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas released its annual Labor Day Outlook. And its conclusion is this miserable job market, it's actually recovering faster than you think. The CEO of the company is John Challenger. Hello.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be with you.
A jobs recovery is underway. How do you figure?
Well, by most accounts, we're barely a year into the recovery. At this point, in the previous two recoveries, following the 91 and 2000 recessions, the job market was actually getting worse. But it seems like so many people are caught up looking at the weekly and monthly numbers that they fail to look at the bigger trends, which indicate just how much the job market's improved over the last year. We've seen 654,000 new jobs created. And those jobs that are getting created are occurring much sooner than when compared with the 2001 recession. At the end of that 2001 recession, it took 21 months before the economy began to add jobs. We actually started adding jobs just 6 months after the end of this recession.
I remember asking an economist, if I had told you a year ago that weekly new unemployment benefit claims would still be around 500,000, she said, no way. You know, I don't want to get too lost in the numbers here, but isn't it just bad?
This was a very deep recession with more people out of work. But if you look at the numbers in terms of just what's changed in the last year, we're averaging right now, the four-week numbers, about 481,000 jobless claims. That's 85,000 less than we saw last year at the same point, August 15th.
Okay, so some job growth is happening. Where's that happening? Where are those jobs being created?
Well, I'll just tell you where the strongest industries are for growth. The export economy is crucial to the U.S. economy in the next period of expansion. In fact, probably throughout the next century, our economy is going to have to grow in part because we supply goods and services to emerging and growing countries around the planet. But also, healthcare is a very strong industry, likely to be one of the sources of real growth in the next expansion. Energy is another industry where there's going to be real investment and growth and jobs.
But John, didn't we dig ourselves such an enormous hole that, you know, even some improvement, we're not overemphasizing. We're not wrong about the suffering, are we?
No, we're certainly not wrong about just how difficult it's been, how many Americans are out there right now who are struggling, who haven't found jobs. But there is reason for hope because it's getting better at a much faster clip coming out of this recession than it has for unemployed people in previous recessions.
All good to hear. John Challenger of Challenger, Gray & Christmas, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am glad he's optimistic because it sure doesn't seem like investors are. The New York Times says small investors withdrew more than $33 billion from domestic stock market mutual funds just in the first 7 months of this year. Trust me, that's a lot. Marketplace's Elisa Roth set out to learn where all that cash is going, and she found out that while money is moving around in the markets, it's not all going one way.
The data behind the New York Times sensational headline comes from the Investment Company Institute. It's a trade association for investment companies, places like mutual funds. Brian Reed is chief economist there. He says it is true. People aren't buying as many American stock funds, but that's not the whole story.
On the other hand, we've seen, you know, relatively steady inflows into funds investing in stocks of foreign companies.
And investors aren't hiding the rest of their money under their mattresses. Actually, Reed says it's impossible to know where people are putting their money. It could be going into bond funds, which are doing well right now.
Anytime we're in an environment in which interest rates are falling and bond returns are rising as bond prices rise, we find investor demand for bond funds pick up.
One reason investors might be taking money out of stocks is because they're nervous. Deborah Neiman's a certified financial planner in Massachusetts. She says some of her older clients have gotten scared and are taking their money out of stocks, but that's because they already have enough money to retire. But she says some younger people are sticking it out.
Younger folks, some are more willing to just be all in, if you will, and just ride the markets, you know, knowing that they have a longer-term horizon. And others who may have been more cautious in the past are a little more cautious, and they maybe have reallocated, scaled back a little on their equity exposure.
In other words, some investors are getting out, but there are plenty of others who want in. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
If a recovery is on the way, stock investors haven't gotten the word. I'll tell you what I mean when we do the numbers. Generally speaking, arts organizations over in Europe have had a pretty good deal. Theaters and museums get a lot of their funding from taxpayers. Well, that's going to have to change. Most European governments are planning deep budget cuts. And in Britain, at least, those arts organizations are being told, folks, it's time to do things like the Yanks do. Christopher Wirth reports on the UK's move toward more private arts funding.
It's opening night at the Bush Theatre in West London, and the cast is running through a few final scenes before showtime.
Take heed, my dear, there's much to fear from fruits we do not grow.
This tiny but influential theatre has been crammed into the rooms above a pub for nearly 40 years. Until now, it received generous public subsidies. But this fall, Britain will slash billions worth of spending. And that means organizations like the Bush Theatre could face cuts as high as 25%. Josie Rourke is the artistic director.
A cut of that magnitude would be grievous. And actually, it would be a very different Bush Theatre.
Arts organizations fear those cuts could force theatres and museums to close all over the country. To make up the shortfall, the government is urging them to raise more private money from wealthy donors and corporate sponsors.
Every arts organization is being told, much to their fury, look at the American system, talk to American donors, see how you can model yourself on an American fundraising pattern.
Colin Tweedy heads up the nonprofit group Arts and Business. He says British arts organizations began copying that American model over the past couple of decades as public funding started to dry up. He says the arts in Britain have faced funding cuts in past downturns, but not quite like this.
The arts community is like sort of Count Dracula. You can't kill a vampire unless you stab it through the heart with a wooden stave. But this time will be different because the recession is so big, so deep, that they won't recover for a generation.
And the last time things were this bad, the UK took a more Keynesian approach. In fact, the economist John Maynard Keynes set up the Arts Council, the body that doles out public money, to kickstart the arts after the Second World War. The council's chief executive, Alan Davey, says a lot of that money gets returned to the government through taxes on things like increased tourism and ticket sales.
If you like, it's R&D venture capital funding. And it produces risky, innovative work that take the art form to new places.
Take the Bush Theatre. It's known for its avant-garde work. It's expected to receive over $800,000 from the Arts Council this year, although now that's up in the air. But Josie Rourke says it will be hard to get wealthy patrons in Britain to cover the difference. And that's because they can't shield their money by giving it away tax-free like donors can in the U.S.
It will really need something big, such as reform of taxation, so that the same or similar tax breaks are available as are in America, which, let's be clear, is one of the very big incentives for giving.
But with the British government short on cash, don't expect to see those tax breaks anytime soon. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
So, if that's how the recession is hitting the boards in Britain, what is the story like here, where arts funding comes from ticket buyers? And even more than that, private donors. My guest is Randy Cohen with the national nonprofit group Americans for the Arts. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What do you think of the assertion you just heard? The British system of government support produces risky, innovative art. Is American art less innovative?
No, the art is very innovative here in the United States. And even in a down economy, we see arts organizations still doing premieres, still doing new work. I don't think we'll ever see a significant decrease in innovation in the arts. Now, that said, when contributed support to the arts decreases, you will see arts organizations sometimes going to more popular kinds of presentations. You know, you look at the typical ballet company in this country, a big piece of its revenue stream is the Nutcracker around the holidays.
And is that a trend, the Nutcrackerization of the arts in America in this recession?
It's hard to say. I think you see some arts organizations keeping a much closer eye on the public demand. I think arts organizations need to focus on how do we increase demand to meet the existing capacity of arts organizations. Then there are also arts organizations are keeping an eye on private sector giving and the trends there. We've seen actually over the last decade a decrease in the share of business giving going to the arts. And in this recession, in fact, obviously the economy has hurt things, but the finance sector has always been the strongest within the business sector of giving to the arts, and of course they've been hit the hardest.
The finance sector? You mean Wall Street is the biggest patron of the arts?
Yes, among corporations, finance sector has always been very strong in supporting the arts, and so it's a bit of a double hit. But overall, what we're seeing is the business sector moving their support out of the charitable giving budgets and more towards marketing-based and sponsorship-oriented budgets. And what that does, that enables businesses to support the arts as well as advance their business, to build markets, to get greater visibility for their investment in the arts. And so it's less of a pure philanthropic contribution. It's more purposeful. Also, though, what we're seeing is an overall shift towards social services, human needs, that type of thing. And so I think that's another issue that a lot of arts organizations are facing as they look at where the contributed dollars are going.
Well, this is part of your job, Randy, is to make the case, and I want to know how you do it, make the case to companies that right now in this recession slump, that the arts, that a new opera is more important than supporting a food bank or job training.
Well, and it's all important, and it's a healthy society has food and shelter needs being met. It also has a vibrant arts community because the arts are a fundamental component of our humanity. It's not an either-or situation. That said, arts organizations are needing to help funders understand the value they bring to the community. And so while that great opera performance or that great museum exhibition helps improve our quality of life, it provides other benefits as well. There's 100,000 nonprofit arts organizations. That supports 5.7 million jobs in this country. If you're a company or a government worried about jobs, that makes the arts a smart investment.
Randy Cohen with Americans for the Arts. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, when your commute is at 30,000 feet, you put a lot of thought into that trip.
I tend to be a pretty big lane sleeper, so I like to put it on fairly quickly in my journey.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 39 points today, about a third of 1%, to close at 10,174. The NASDAQ gave back 20 points, almost 1%, to end at 2159, and the S&P 500 slid 4 points, that's about 0.4%. The close was 1067. Shares of 3PAR, the object of that bidding war I told you about, vaulted 44% higher, but its two suitors didn't fare so well. HP dropped 2%, Dell shed 1%. Meantime, the fertilizer king I mentioned, Potash of Saskatchewan, beat back a hostile takeover bid by BHP Billiton. Shares of Potash rose more than a third of a percent. BHP slipped nearly half a percent. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.6%. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Environmental Protection Agency hosts a hearing about potential changes to water quality regulations. The National Association of Realtors reports on existing home sales for the month of July. And 4 years ago, Pluto got demoted and became a dwarf planet when the International Astronomical Union redefined the term planet. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke in for Kai Ryssdal. And we talked earlier in the show about how small investors are fleeing the stock market. We gave some possible reasons. Maybe they're nervous about the economy. Maybe they prefer the safety of bonds. Or maybe people are just still freaked out from the flash crash. Remember the stomach-dropping plunge this spring when almost 1,000 points just vanished from the Dow in a few minutes and then reappeared just as fast? Well, a group called the Financial Industry Regulatory Association is still struggling to explain exactly what happened, but over the weekend it announced a probe that could lay some of the blame on high-frequency trading. We've told you about these, those high-tech, high-speed computer trades that now account for most of the buying and selling on Wall Street. Well, commentator Matt Samuelson now says high-frequency trading might sound intimidating, but let's not make it the enemy.
Wild swings in the stock market always trigger a hunt for the boogeyman. Short sellers used to be the favorite target for blame, then algorithmic traders. Today, it's high-frequency trading. It's easy to blame high-frequency trading because most people know so little about it. Talk of super-fast computers and complicated algorithms makes it sound like a sinister plotline from the movie The Terminator. In reality, high-frequency trading is quite simple. It generally involves the frequent buying and selling of securities to profit from small changes in price. The computers used in high-frequency trading are extremely smart. They're programmed to spot the best time to make trades. They're quite fast, too. Orders are often executed in as little as 1/10,000th of a second. Being faster, and maybe even smarter, than a human trader isn't a bad thing. High-frequency strategies squeeze every ounce of value out of the market in ways that humans can't. They add value in other ways, too. In some instances, they buy and sell stock purely to collect rebates. By doing this, they provide shares that otherwise wouldn't be available, easing the pressure of supply and demand. They also identify stocks in which the market price has diverged from fundamental value. In taking advantage of these instances, they correct the mispricing, pushing market price back in line with fundamental price. In other words, rather than creating problems in the market, high-frequency trading often solves them. It provides more stock for people to buy and sell, it often results in better execution prices, and it helps smooth out ups and downs in price movement. They were the first to see that prices were far lower than they should have been. They bought in, and they drove the market back almost to where it had started. It's true that high-frequency trading is reshaping our stock markets, and it's right that regulators should want to investigate. Hopefully, once regulators and legislators gain a full understanding of HFT, they'll see the enormous benefits that it can bring. Hopefully then, we'll stop hearing the paranoid rants about the rise of the machines.
Matt Samuelson is a principal at the independent consulting firm Woodbine Associates. We hope you will share your thoughts with High Frequency. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says Contact. I hope you've been able to find a little time off this summer, a chance to get away from the routine. For some people, getting away, that is their routine. The business traveler has a special relationship with the road, and we've been finding out this summer how musical that relationship can be. Producer Michael Rayfield's been bringing us a series called Road Warriors, where you get to tap into people's headphones and hear the soundtracks they choose when they are working so far from home. Today, the line of work is women's fashion, and the in-flight music is key.
I'm Bonnie Wisnowski. I am the director of visual presentation for Eileen Fisher. When I am out on the road, I listen to the song The Funeral by Band of Horses.
I'm coming up only to hold you under. And coming up only to show.
I start listening to this song usually when I get settled into the plane. It's even usually before takeoff. I tend to be a pretty big plane sleeper, so I like to put it on fairly quickly in my journey so that I can kind of ground myself and mellow out and ignore everybody around me and listen in hopes that I'll fall asleep. See me on an airplane, do not talk to me. No. I love when I'm traveling because I get to be creative. And honestly, most of my merchandising I do nowadays is on paper, or I think with teams about concepts, but when I'm actually on the road is when I get to try to bring it to life. I imagine it's like somebody who is a carpenter, always only sketching and planning and designing versus actually building, and when they actually build, it comes to life. That's sort of what it's like for me with merchandising. To go install some windows at Bloomingdale's in San Francisco this last spring, and the team that I did it with was totally incredible, and we would get up at the crack of dawn just so that we could be done by 4 o'clock and then take the rental car and get out of the city, and we went and drove all around the beaches, and it was breathtaking. So it was kind of neat to think, okay, I was in a Bloomingdale's window 2 hours ago, and now I'm on a beach that has black sand and like huge crashing waves. I'm coming up only to show. Maybe I shouldn't be saying how much I like it, because then everybody's gonna be like, you can't go anymore. And coming up only to show you roll.
You know, we've got a whole music section on our website where you can listen to some of Bonnie's other favorites, and you can offer up your own playlist, your own suggestions. Our listeners definitely do jump into the musical fray, as you will see in the comment section when you go to our homepage, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, all you local governments hurting for money, here's a revenue source that never ends. Charge your residents for being lazy. Cleveland is about to start embedding its trash and recycling bins with barcodes and radio frequency ID chips, so the city will know exactly how often you roll your carts to the curb for collection. If it's been weeks since you put out your recycling, a city worker will sort through your trash. If more than 10% of the stuff in there is recyclable, you could be fined $100. The city says the surveillance is not just about the environment, it's about the budget. Cleveland pays $30 a ton to dump garbage into landfills. It earns $26 a ton for recyclables. So if Mother Nature doesn't move you, think of your children's debt load. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 39 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ gave back 20 points, almost 1%. And the S&P 500 slid 4 points, or 0.4%. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to my colleagues, my people at the Marketplace Morning Report, for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, is the World's Fair becoming too much of a sponsorship circus?
The no smoking signs are sponsored by Pfizer. Every last thing in this pavilion, has a corporate sponsor on it.
I'm Bill Radke. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.